With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, we hear from U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack on plans for more investments in rural America. But our top story today, the government is again about to run out of money with a shutdown cliff next week and a farm bill extension hanging in the balance. Another stopgap funding bill by the 17th would likely be the vehicle to extend the already expired farm bill. But new House Speaker Mike Johnson told Fox News Sunday that he'll fight for a non-traditional stopgap instead of continued level funding.
What we call on Capitol Hill a continuing resolution now, and what we've dealt with in years past, is that this would allow us time, and everybody understands, allow us time to continue this appropriations process. We're committed to bringing 12 bills to the floor as the law, statutory law requires Congress to do. That hasn't been done in many years.
And to do so, Johnson has proposed, with a possible laddered approach of multiple deadlines as annual spending bills are passed, which is unlikely to win Senate support. Without a short-term deal, a farm bill extension would languish. Top House Ag Democrat David Scott has now called for a one-year extension, matching similar calls by Senate Ag leaders and resistance to more limits on SNAP.
We stand united against any efforts to take food away from children, families, or any vulnerable American in this farm bill or any legislation.
Republicans have dug in as well. House Ag Chair Glenn Thompson.
Let's move from states going out of their way to keep employable individuals idle and disengaged and spend more time fostering connections with employers and education providers.
With no time left for a new farm bill this year and a perilous fight over a routine stopgap bill and farm law extension, the next 10 days will be critical in determining the direction of farm and other policies. Uncertain global grain market developments pose major challenges to analysts trying to forecast market prospects. Gary Crawford has details.
There's always new data to comb through, new issues to try to figure out, and this month is no exception.
USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jackanowski talking about this Thursday's new round of forecasts for crop supplies, exports, domestic use, stocks, and prices, which Mark says could be affected by a range of uncertain issues, such as recently
a pretty strong surge in U.S. exports of soybean meal, and that has supported the markets for soybean meal and therefore also, you know, the prices of soybeans to some degree.
But will that continue? And if so, to what extent? Also, experts are watching crop conditions in South America. And meanwhile, in another part of the world,
there's still continues to be a lot of uncertainty with regard to Ukraine's ability to export.
We'll get USDA's latest take on all of this Thursday noon Eastern Time. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour, and it's available on both Apple and Android devices. This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen, and we will be right back. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour. I'm your host, Sabrina Halvorsen. In today's National Spotlight, changes in drought coverage over the last few months have had an impact on spring-planted crops around the nation. Here's Rod Bain with more.
October has come and gone. The summer crop growing and harvest season is pretty much over. In the case of the final U.S. drought monitor for the 10th month of the year, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey notes it is usually a time to reflect on drought coverage over some of the nation's major commodities. He starts with a look at corn and soybean growing areas covered in drought for the period ending October 31st.
Corn, 36% of the production area in drought at the end of October. And that's just a way of saying that we have seen that number come down substantially from earlier in the summer. Very similarly with soybeans, 38% of the production area currently in drought. That's down from 63% on June 27th.
However, for some southern row crops,
like cotton and peanuts, we saw substantial increases in drought coverage as the season went on.
Cotton production area in drought rose from 15% in June to 49% by October's end.
Peanuts also took a turn for the worse. Only 4% of the peanut production area was in drought on July 11th. That has now risen to 46%, and some of our major southeastern production areas affected by that late season flash drought.
Rippey turns his attention next to hay and cattle areas in drought at the end of October.
Hay in drought, 36% is the number that we see, and that follows a period of significant increase in the hay production area in drought. We saw a rise from 29 to 42% between late July and October 24th, but then substantial rains at the end of October dropping that number to 42 to 36%.
While for cattle in drought,
current number, 37% of the U.S. cattle inventory in drought, and that follows a period of a steady rise from 34 to 47% in drought between mid-August and early October.
One crop in its development season at the moment, winter wheat. And regarding drought coverage of winter wheat growing areas,
as of October 31st, 42% of the winter wheat production area in the United States in drought. That number has been hovering in the 40s since planting season began a few weeks ago.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Meanwhile, after a lengthy drought, some parts of the upper Midwest have turned wet, but only in spots. Dennis Toddy, director of the Midwest Climate Hub, says fall is typically a time when that farm country sees more rain.
By the time you get around to the fall, crops have stopped growing, plants have stopped using water out of the soil. We don't get as much rainfall, as much total precipitation in the fall as we do during the summer. But on the offside, we don't have plants drawing it out of the soil. So this is the time for soil moisture recharge. And we typically get a couple of those bigger systems that drop widespread precipitation, and we hadn't had those yet.
A cold snap this week in the upper Midwest was more of a surprise.
And that we expected some cold to come, but not for it to be a big shot to a big transition like this. So it's a little rougher, a little windier as we speak now, windy and cold, but fortunately it's going to be fairly short-lived and start to moderate here within a few days.
In terms of fall rainfall, it's been a case of the haves versus the have-nots in the Midwest and Corn Belt.
Parts of Wisconsin received some pretty good rainfalls over the last few weeks. Minnesota, Iowa, parts of the Dakotas also. East central Iowa received some and parts of Illinois. But when you get down into central to southern Iowa, they've received not as much. Parts of Illinois have missed out. Still parts of Wisconsin could use some rainfall too. So kind of spotty.
He talks about the upcoming forecast as farmers work to finish the 2023 harvest.
You know, as you look in the 6 to 10 day and 8 to 14 day outlook that were released yesterday from the Climate Prediction Center, by the time that week two rolls around, about the western half of the country, it looks like it has a better chance of being above average in the way of temperatures. The Great Lakes area and Ohio Valley are near normal, which still is moderation from where we are right now. And then from a precipitation standpoint, it does look like there are some decent chances for precipitation coming in next week, again, over parts of the Midwest. We're still kind of waiting to see how that pans out.
Meanwhile, sugar beet harvest is in full swing for U.S. producers in the 11 major sugar beet producing states, which include California, Colorado, Idaho, Michigan, Minnesota, Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, Oregon, Washington, and Wyoming. Jack Breidenbach, president of the Colorado Sugar Beet Growers Association, says it's a positive situation right now for the industry.
The sugar market is strong and got a solid demand, and the prices are solid. So we're just pretty positive at this time with the beets.
Sugar beet content is averaging 18% sugar, with tonnage at about 29 tons per acre, and about 10% of the crop is left to be harvested. He says all sugar produced in the U.S. stays in the U.S.
We raise about 85% of our domestically used sugar. 85% of the sugar that's used in the U.S. is grown. The other 15% is imported. And 55% of the domestic grown crop is sugar beets, and the other is from sugar cane. The larger portion is from sugar beet crop. All the northern states grow sugar beets, and the southern states like Louisiana and Florida, some in Texas, they grow sugar cane. But it's all used for the same purposes.
Breidenbach says the sugar is used mainly in bulk sugar bakeries and soft drinks. That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Randall Wisewind with today's Livestock Report.
Well, in today's livestock news, last month the International Dairy Federation's World Dairy Summit was held in Chicago, and the National Milk Producers Federation turned out in full force. Numerous speakers were on hand for the event, and a special recognition was actually made for NMPF President and CEO Jim Mulhern. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack honored Mulhern for his exemplary leadership and decades of service to the U.S. dairy community, commending him for his four decades of professional service for ag and dairy. Now, this was the first summit hosted in the U.S. in 30 years. It was brought to Chicago in large part by the NMPF, U.S. Dairy Export Council, and Dairy Management Incorporated leadership. Shauna Morris, NMPF and USDEC Executive Vice President for Trade Policy and Global Affairs, and Nick Gardner, USDEC Senior Vice President for Sustainability and Multilateral Affairs, co-chaired the event. They oversaw the development of a conference that highlighted the U.S. dairy industry's leadership on a variety of issues. Jamie Jonker, Chief Science Officer and Vice President for Sustainability and Scientific Affairs, served as IDF's Chair of the Science and Program Coordination Committee and was prominently involved in multiple areas of the summit. NMPF and its members had a significant presence throughout the conference. U.S. Dairy Export Council's Krista Harden moderated an event where 24 participants discussed the challenges that beginning farmers face around the world. And during the close of the summit, IDF released a statement approved earlier that week by the General Assembly that delivered a unified message on how the global dairy sector is working to sustainably nourish people while supporting planet health and communities. If you'd like to learn more about the International Dairy Federation's World Dairy Summit, you can go to the National Milk Producers Federation website, nmpf.org. And an auctioneer from Florida was recently awarded top honors at the World Livestock Auctioneer Championship Qualifier. It was held at the Tri-County Stockyards up in Motley, Minnesota. According to the Livestock Marketing Association, 35 competitors from all over the U.S. battled it out for an opportunity to call bids at the annual World Livestock Auctioneering Championship. It'll be held next June at the Oklahoma National Stockyards. And at the end of the day, during this qualifying event, Marcus Kent from Dunellen, Florida, came out on top. Now, the reserve champion was Joshua Garcia of Carn City, Texas. Rounding out the top three, runner-up champion Dakota Davis from Wacomas, Oklahoma. Now, the World Livestock Auctioneering Championship and its qualifying events don't just bring bid callers together. The events did draw spectators in the bleachers and from all over the world via a live stream. Now, one more qualifying event will be held in Paris, Kentucky, November the 16th, and it will decide the remainder of the championship semifinal field. If you'd like to learn more about the World Livestock Auctioneering Competition, go to the LMA website, lmaweb.com. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report. But first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's Agnet West headlines, here's Brian German.
Climate change is anticipated to cause a significant rise in agricultural pests for specialty crop farmers, as outlined in a recent study by researchers from the University of California Agriculture and Natural Resources and the U.S. Department of Agriculture California Climate Hub. The study, published in the Journal of Science of the Total Environment, reveals that increasing temperatures linked to climate change are the primary driver behind the expected surge in populations of three major insect pests: coddling moth, peach twig borer, and oriental fruit moth. These pests are particularly problematic for walnut, almond, and peach orchards, causing extensive damage and reducing fruit and nut quality. The research emphasizes the urgency for farmers, especially those in the specialty crops industry, to be aware of the impending challenges posed by increased pest pressure. The study highlights the importance of implementing adaptive strategies and staying informed about climate-related changes to safeguard the specialty crops industry. The impact of climate change on the timing of seasons characterized by warmer winters, earlier springs, and hotter summers is identified as a key factor disrupting the natural life cycles of these pests. A significant amount of federal funding has been put towards supporting climate-smart ag practices. U.S. Department of Agriculture Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation Robert Bonney was recently in Fresno County visiting a dairy that's implementing some of the climate-smart ag practices that are being supported through increased funding. Undersecretary Bonney highlighted the value these types of investments can provide.
So we've gotten significant new resources for NRCS through the Inflation Reduction Act. So we have $19.5 billion in new resources, primarily targeted to our traditional conservation programs. And the president and the secretary announced earlier this week a $1.1 billion announcement of the Regional Conservation Partnership Program of projects across the country. $800 million of that is from the Inflation Reduction Act resources that are connected to climate mitigation. We're looking for ways that we can work through voluntary incentive-based approaches, partnerships, markets, and the project we're featuring today is part of that effort. And U.S. dairy is already very efficient from a greenhouse gas standpoint, but there are lots of opportunities to do more and looking for ways that we can make it work for producers, for the environment at the same time is a critical part of the approach here. And so we're excited to highlight this work today.
Grape growers faced a variety of challenges this year due to abnormal weather patterns. BASF Tech Service Rep for the Southern San Joaquin Valley, Kevin Caffrey, said disease pressures were severe this season.
I think most would say it was the worst powdery mildew in recent history. It came on early. A lot of people were trying to early on. Maybe they didn't have as intensive programs. And part of that was because the last few years they got away with it. They could have some lighter early programs and still control the pest. That was not the case this year. And once you get powdery mildew, it's not easy to eradicate it. The people that started early and started strong, they did pretty well. They were able to make it through the powdery mildew season. The difficult thing with powdery mildew is you get scars from powdery mildew. Even if you kill all the disease, that means you're going to get a bunch of bunch rot. On top of that, there are areas, especially in Fresno and Tulare County, that we got a rain in July, right when Verasion hit. And 48 hours after that rain, you had the strong smell of vinegar from all the sour bunch rot.
Next week, the Chico State College of Agriculture is hosting the second annual Precision Ag Day. The event is being held on Wednesday, November 15th, beginning at 9 a.m. at the Chico State University Farm. The first part of the morning will feature live demonstrations of equipment and technology and provide attendees with an opportunity to learn from company representatives. This year, the event will feature companies in both plant and animal agriculture to meet the needs of producers in the North State. In addition to the company demonstrations, the 2023 event will feature Women in Ag, Ag Tech panel discussions by Ag and Technology entrepreneurs. Last year's inaugural event welcomed nearly 200 farmers, ranchers, college students, and members of the agriculture community to the farm to learn about the latest advancements in precision agriculture. More information about the Precision Ag Day is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. Research suggests that the new beetle species that was recently identified in California poses a risk to almonds, walnuts, and pistachios. Cooperative Extension Specialist Houston Wilson said that efforts are underway to better understand the prevalence of the beetle known as Carpophilus truncatus.
You know, when I found this infestation at this first site and we confirmed the species identification, I started contacting other growers and pest control advisors that I've worked with over the years and, you know, showing them pictures of what I had found and asking, you know, hey, have you ever seen this before? And surprisingly, a number of people have been seeing something like that. And not necessarily linking it up with crop damage per se. I think there's a good chance that I can see how folks would confuse it with maybe, you know, damage from some other insects, basically. So what we did after we had the find in Madera County is I initiated a regional survey of the San Joaquin Valley to delineate the population to see how widespread is this thing. And we now have confirmed finds from both almond and pistachio. And we have official identifications from Merced County, Madera County, and Kings County. And as I mentioned, we're in the process of taking in samples from all the other counties in the San Joaquin Valley. And currently, we're sorting through a lot of beetles now to identify in the lab. And we've been going through those. And, you know, we should be able to produce a map, hopefully, in the next few weeks that shows the full extent of the infestation. But already, you know, given that we're seeing it, you know, you take Merced all the way down to Kings County, that north-south swath there, that's already pretty widespread. So I'm anticipating that we'll be finding it in other counties in the San Joaquin Valley.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Don't forget, if you have missed any of our morning shows or simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet NewsHour, and it's available on both Apple and Android devices. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Most of us are flunking the clean hand test, at least in our kitchens. Gary Crawford has more.
Most people missed this, but October 15th was Global Hand Washing Day. It was also my birthday. That about says it on that score, but maybe that bad fanfare should apply to our hand-washing efforts, or lack thereof. The Agriculture Department has been doing several years of research studies on food safety, and so, in this case, they put people in test kitchens and had them prepare certain meals, and the researchers would then watch what goes on. In this case, watching to see if people are washing their hands every time they're supposed to, and if they're washing their hands the way they're supposed to for food safety. And the result?
Hand-washing is not anywhere near where we would hope it to be amongst consumers.
Certainly not. That's Meredith Carruthers with USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service. She says the study shows without a doubt when it comes to hand washing when preparing meals, almost all of us flunk the course.
We have found that participants are failing to properly clean their hands up to 99% of the time before and during meal preparation.
Well, now here's how the study was carried out. For a certain meal, food experts identified several spots along the way in the preparation and cooking process that hands should be washed to avoid any bacterial cross-contamination problems from raw meat and poultry onto other foods or plates or utensils and onto other surfaces in the test kitchen, and then off those surfaces and back to the meat and poultry products. Now, multiply the number of spots where hand washing is called for times the number of test participants, and in this particular case, you get 1,003 hand washing events that should have happened. But
ultimately, of these 1,003 cases, hand washing was attempted only 5% of the time that it was required, and about 72% of participants attempted to wash their hands before beginning meal preparation, which is great. But among these hand washing attempts, only 5% of them contained the correct steps for hand washing and were considered successful.
And those steps for effective hand washing, according to the Centers for Disease Control, are
wet hands with water, rub hands with soap for at least 20 seconds, rinse hands with water, and dry hands using a clean one-use towel.
Which, as you heard, hardly anybody did all of that. Biggest mistake:
not rubbing hands with soap for 20 seconds.
As this little rap song goes:
wash them, rub them, and please make sure you scrub them.
But despite a lot of effort in trying to get people to do that, the studies so far show almost total rejection of good hand washing practices, at least in the studies so far. Now, these studies, though, were done pre-COVID. Meredith Carruthers says they're gearing up to do another study now that COVID's part of the picture.
To help determine how some of these behaviors have changed as a result.
Or if they've really changed at all, at least in America's kitchens. This is Dex. Okay, I'll wash my hands the right way. Just don't make me listen to this again. This is Gary Crawford. I'm washing my hands of the whole situation. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Make it stop.
The Agriculture Secretary's visit to the 96th Annual National FFA Convention included memorable moments and recognition. Here's Rod Bain.
Among the National FFA Organization's highest honors.
The Honorary American FFA degree is used to recognize individuals who have rendered outstanding service to agricultural education in the FFA.
2022-23 FFA Southern Region Vice President McKenna Clifton with the description of this award. And during this year's National FFA Convention in Indianapolis, a presentation.
It is truly an honor to bestow upon you the Honorary American FFA degree.
The recipient, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack.
Just let me say thank you very much. I'm really touched by this. My wife and I often talk about all of you, and we have concluded if it was up to us, we'd put the young people of FFA in charge of the country. You understand the importance of this country. You understand the value of hard work. You understand the importance of cooperation and collaboration. You really do represent the best of the best. So I take this honor with deep gratitude.
The Honorary American FFA degree presentation occurred immediately after the secretary took the stage to provide remarks during the opening ceremony of the 96th Annual National FFA Convention. His presentation was to those constituting the future of agriculture.
I know this convention is filled with future farmers, entrepreneurs, scientists, veterinarians, government officials, bankers, business leaders, and teachers.
The secretary says their skills and motivation will be needed to address some of the most challenging issues they will face in the future.
Climate change, food security, and growing income inequality.
Yet he told FFA members in attendance and watching the convention live stream that experiences gained through FFA
prepare you to face these challenges with bold solutions, clear thought, and an eye toward progress. I'm here today to say very clearly, I believe in the future of agriculture because I believe in you, our next generation of agriculture leaders.
The National FFA Convention was also memorable for the Secretary in that he lent his signature to renew the 5-year Memorandum of Understanding between USDA and National FFA.
It truly is a great organization. I'm watching my grandson, who's an FFA member, going through the process, and what this organization is able to do with young people is to give them the skill set to be confident about their capacity to lead and to make a difference.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Educators will get a full Farm Bureau convention experience. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The American Farm Bureau Foundation for Agriculture and Nationwide have teamed up to bring outstanding educators to the American Farm Bureau's annual convention on January 19th through the 22nd, 2024. Selected educators will receive an exclusive and immersive experience. They'll receive free registration for the 2024 AFBF convention in Salt Lake City, Utah, as well as financial reimbursement for travel, lodging, and meals while attending the event. The experience will connect teachers with farmers and ranchers from across the country to hear directly about modern farming. Highlights will include participation in local ag tours, networking with farmers, ranchers, and other professionals involved in ag education, and access to many other events. Daniel Malloy, executive director of the AFBF Foundation, says they're proud to support teachers from all across the country in several ways, and they hope they'll leave the 2024 convention with new ideas and information about agriculture to take back to their classrooms. Don't forget, if you have missed any of our morning shows or simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet NewsHour, and it's available on both Apple and Android devices. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. President Biden announced more than $5 billion in new investments from his Investing in America agenda. He says to advance rural prosperity, economic development, competition, and sustainability. I talked with Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack about the announcement to get more details on what exactly we can be expecting. Here is that conversation.
The energy program and the money that's going to be added for that, how can that help agricultural producers, the Rural Energy for America program?
I think two ways. Obviously, to the extent that farmers, ranchers, and producers utilize renewable energy, it will lower their utility costs. And allow them to basically redirect those savings into a better bottom line for the family or to continued investments in their operation. Secondly, I think it positions farmers who take full advantage of the Renewable Energy for America program to potentially work together and collaboratively with other farmers in their area where they are capable of producing not just the electricity they need for their own operation, but in fact can produce excess electricity or excess power on the farm. The question is, what can be done with that excess power? Well, it's possible as RECs, as rural electric cooperatives, begin to transition from a reliance on fossil fuel generation to more reliance on renewable energy sources for the generation of electricity to lower costs for everybody in their REC area, that farmers can band together and essentially pool that excess electricity that they're producing and utilize that in a purchase agreement where the utility will basically purchase that excess electricity. That becomes a new income source. So in addition to lowering costs over time, our belief is there's an opportunity for additional income to be generated. Now, the reason I'm confident that RECs will be interested in that is because we have $9.7 billion in the New Era program and $1 billion in the PACE program from the Inflation Reduction Act, which are designed to incent and encourage the RECs to consider that transition. And we've seen enormous interest when we put these resources on the table. We've seen hundreds of RECs across the country express a desire with literally almost 1,000 projects potentially that would be interested in this transition opportunity. So I think it's not only reducing the cost for farmers, but it's also significantly creating new income opportunities in the future.
Another issue that is big for our farmers, and I'm kind of going backwards here as far as the funding amounts go, but the rural high-speed internet infrastructure, the administration continues to work on that and helping to get internet to everybody in America. What will the new funding for this go to?
Well, there are $274 million being announced as part of our ReConnect program. The ReConnect program is looking at improving access to or providing access to high-speed internet. Many communities have access, but it's not high speed. Some communities do not have any access at all. And this program, we're announcing $274 million that will go to projects in eight states. We think that there will be roughly 36,000 people across those eight states that will have access to high-speed internet. They'll also have the opportunity to take full advantage of the affordable connectivity program, which essentially enables the individuals to get a tax credit that will offset the cost of a low-cost program providing access to the internet. Now, the way in which this becomes important to farmers in an area that will take advantage of this program is that farmers will be utilizing the internet for precision agriculture. They have a better understanding of the nature of their operation, of the condition of their soil, of ways in which they can significantly reduce potentially the amount of inputs that are required on a particular acre based on data and information they can collect if they have access to the internet. This ReConnect program is part of the Inflation Reduction Act, a part of the bipartisan infrastructure law. And the additional part of that infrastructure law was to create an additional fund for the Commerce Department that is now being provided to individual states. And that money will essentially be also utilized to expand access in rural and remote areas that currently do not have access. Those areas in every state that exist where the coverage just isn't what it needs to be. And so at the end of the investment, once all those resources are put to work, we should have a circumstance in America where nobody is being denied access to high-speed internet. And as you know, that's not just about farmers and precision agriculture. It's about distance learning for rural schools. It's about telemedicine for rural hospitals and clinics. It's about small business market expansion for small businesses and manufacturing concerns, significantly expanding their reach. So it's incredibly important to economic opportunity, which is why the administration has made an historic investment in once and for all providing high-speed internet for all.
We are talking with Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. There is more to the conversation, so we will be back in just a moment with the rest of this chat. Welcome back. We are talking this morning with Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack about President Biden's announcement of new investments in rural America. Here we continue our interview segment.
The biggest amount of spending funding is going to creating jobs and supporting the rural economy, and that was a $2 billion investment. How can our listeners in rural areas expect to see that in action?
Well, that specific investment is directed at what are called rural partnership network communities. These are 36 communities that are located in 10 states, and the 36 communities have something in common, which is that they have been persistently poor for decades, where the poverty rate exceeds 20% and has exceeded that rate for literally decades. And so these resources are essentially being awarded to communities in those 36 areas in 10 states and Puerto Rico in an effort to try to begin to reverse the persistent poverty that they've seen. It's 20 different federal agencies basically working in collaboration with one another and the communities to determine how best to make the investments to move it forward. I think for other communities that are outside the rural partnership network, it's the investments in infrastructure that are also important to note. When you improve the reliability and the affordability of rural electric, you're obviously making a big difference to everybody in a rural area that's benefiting from an REC that's improving its transmission lines so that the next storm doesn't knock them out. To the extent that you have more reliable electricity, there's obviously a lot of benefits to that. Particularly in life-threatening circumstances where you need to make that that call, or where you need to have power, or you need to have your operating room at your hospital, for example, operating. You need renewable energy or reliable energy. And so the investments that are being made in rural electric and also in water quality are specifically directed to the safety of individuals as well as to the economic opportunity that can be created. And those are a result of really historic amounts being invested from the infrastructure law and the Inflation Reduction Act. So when you look at the total package and then you look at additional investments that have been announced before, this is all new money. This is all new resources being made available that were not available until now. When you look at the totality of investment that's been made by this administration in rural places, you can see that it really is historic and a generational opportunity for real economic opportunity.
Yeah, and you know, there has been a fairly consistent investment in rural America from this administration, and now there seems to be a big push. What was it that brought on this next wave, I guess, of really focusing on rural Americans?
Well, I think I had an opportunity to visit with the president recently, and I explained to him the circumstances that have taken place over the last 40 years or so. In 1981, then-Secretary Bob Berglund, Secretary of Agriculture at the time, noted concerns about the focus on productivity in American agriculture and raised and suggested that perhaps this would lead to bigger farms and fewer farmers. And I don't think anybody fully understood and appreciated the level and extent to which his concerns over the next 40 years actually came to fruition. What we've seen is a loss of 437,000 farms since that 1981 report. 141 million acres of land that was at one time farmed is no longer being farmed because of cities expanding. So the question I think that I raised with the president is, are we okay with that? And clearly the president's not okay with it. He thinks there ought to be an opportunity for families to be able to say to their sons and daughters and grandkids, you have an opportunity to do what I've done, which is to farm a ranch and to pass it on to your sons and daughters and your grandsons and granddaughters. When you have a substantial number of farms being lost, the question is why? Secretary Perdue in 2019 suggested it was because the only option in American agriculture was to get big or get out. The president Biden directed me to essentially create another option. And over the course of the last 2.5 years, we've been working to create that other option through climate smart agriculture, through renewable energy, through the development of bio-based products, through local and regional food systems, to more competition with processing, to lower fertilizer costs. All of this is designed to create new opportunities for farmers so that instead of getting big or getting out, they can get entrepreneurial. And the investments being announced today are just a continuation of that strategy to create new opportunities, more opportunities, innovative opportunities, and to improve the infrastructure that will allow those opportunities to really take hold. And I think you're going to continue to see that from this administration.
So, you know, my last question is there anything else that you want our listeners to know or any other key points that you just really want to make with them?
Well, I think just one other point, which is the reason we do this is because this is a very important place in America. Rural America is incredibly important to the entire country. It's where our food comes from. A significant amount of our water is impacted by what happens in rural places. Most of the feedstock that generates all the power that we use to, you know, plug our computers in and turn on the lights and operate our businesses and farm, all of that comes basically from rural places. It's the iconic landscapes of the country are located in rural places, and it disproportionately sends sons and daughters into the military service. So it's an important place to America. And I think this administration, by making these investments, is really trying to suggest and indicate to all of America that economic opportunity can't be just in the suburbs, can't just be in the urban centers. It's got to be across the country. And as the president likes to say, zip code shouldn't be a determinant of economic opportunity, and we need to rebuild and strengthen the middle class from the bottom up and the middle out, and there's no better place to do that than in rural places.
Thank you once again to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.